When we were kids, we used to have occasionally watched MacGyver. This dates me. This very much definitely dates me. I looked it up on the internet. It was in the mid-80s. It was was first screened. Do you remember MacGyver? Does anyone remember MacGyver? Okay. So it was Friday night, I think. And one particular episode, MacGyver was fighting off a wave of ants that was, I don't know, approaching a farm in the Amazon. There was this huge, like a river of ants, and he had this flame torch that he was trying to eradicate the ants or prevent, but they were going to eat him and everybody else. They were coming for them, you know. And I remember that image very clearly, that very vivid picture of these ants. And ever since then, a big heap of ants would remind me of that frightening image. And I had a few nightmares about ants as a child. And I was probably only about 10 years old, so now you can really work it out that I'm much older than many of you. And but it made a big impression on me, and I can still remember it. So while watching ants the other day with my kids, and I saw how vulnerable these little things are to being squashed by inquisitive three-year-old fingers, I chuckled as to how I could ever have had nightmares about ants. Because really, they are small, and even the big ones you get in Durban can still be squashed easily by three-year-old fingers. and even if they bite, it's not such a bad bite. Okay, so in reality, ants will not come and attack me, and they will not come and attack you. Okay? There are much more vicious things to worry about in Africa. Okay, but the power of the script writer of MacGyver, the director, and the seemingly good acting, for me as a 10-year-old at least, changed that reality for me for a while. And if you can, I've been reading a lot about education, in particular reading about education lately, and in the late 1800s, or reading about education in the late 1800s, and so I found these beautiful descriptions of children having tea with their parents, discussing poetry and the Bible and listening to classical music in the background and morals of life and all sorts. And I was thinking, wow, in those days it was a lot easier to impart values to your children. I mean, there was not many distractions around. Today, we have a barrage of media that's just like imposed on us everywhere we look. We have to have cell phone free zones to stop us from sitting on our phones the whole day in our offices. And this media wants to inform our lives. It wants to dictate how we think even. And we have to become much more judicious, that means thinking and discerning, about what we allow into our eyes. Okay, and this is, I don't mean just what we see, but what we interpret and how we interpret what we see. Okay, so I have a training ophthalmologist here who's going to help me here and there because Jerusha knows very well, and we should also know, we don't just see through our eyes, we see with our eyes rather, we see through our eyes. Okay, it's really just light reflecting onto the, or arriving on the back of our, in the retina, that gets transferred via, you know, electrical impulses to our posterior part of the brain, where it's interpreted as an image. So it has to go through a whole lot of processing centers. And in the process of processing sight, we have lots of other things that interfere with that, hopefully, so we can decide, is this real or is it just a fictional, a pretend story on TV, or is it something I must run away from? Okay. Look at somebody next to you, not too close if they don't relate to you, but look in their eye for a moment, please, if you can. Okay. Some beautiful eyes around here, I'm sure. Okay. So Matthew 6, verse 22 to 23 says, "The eye is the lamp of the body." Now look back at that person and say to them, "The eye is the lamp of the body." Okay. So look here again. So if your eye is healthy, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eye is bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light in you is darkness, how great is the darkness? I just love the word of God. It's like this analogy of the eye is an exquisite analogy to use to explain light and darkness. Because you can even see in people's eyes, actually, if there's a darkness in their lives. I've seen that many times. And but the eyes is such an important entry point into the soul, let's say. And you see here in the word, in Matthew 6, that Jesus has used the singular. He doesn't say the eyes are the lamp of the body. He says the eye is the lamp of the body. So he's not just talking about the organ, the eye, each of the eyes. He's saying the process of sight, of discernment, of bringing knowledge into your brain and assessing it and determining whether it's true or false. Okay? So what we read on the Facebook, internet, Twitter, what we see on TV must come in through the scrutiny of our spiritual eyes. Okay? The eye without the brain is not very useful. Okay? It's very specialized bunch of cells, but it's got no use if it doesn't have an optic nerve connecting it to the brain. Okay? So, in the same way, our eyes that we use, our brains, even our physical minds, are no use without the leading of the Holy Spirit to determine and discern and to look on life as if looking at life through the eyes of the Creator. Okay. I've also been thinking, God made it in such a way that we can't look into our own eyes unless you develop some sort of contraption that, I don't know, cut off one side and had a U-turn, I don't know. You can never look into your own eye. You can always look outward. We have other things reflecting on our eyes. And Jesus can look onto our eyes, but we can't, and we can look onto His eyes, but we can't look into our own eyes. Just think about that, and we'll bring it back later. I think you can go on to the next one. Yeah. So this is just a little image to show you how light was refracted through the eye. I couldn't find the image I was really looking for, but from there it goes right through to your back of your brain. Okay, you can. Just go one more. That's great. Stop there. Okay. So, media over the past 60 years, since they worked out how to make light flash through a TV screen at us, our world has dramatically changed. Okay. Instead of sitting around having a tea party with your parents, now you have access to the world out there, and no longer just TV, but through the computer, internet, all sorts of stuff. So values have been replaced largely with what the media tells us and how we feel about things. And it's been especially the enemy's old tactic has come through most of the time, with bringing to us a place of complete disregard for authority. So, you know, the parents were displaced by the TV, and even the teachers now are being displaced by the TV and the computer. So thankfully our brains are not displaced. So let's read what Rabbi Zacharias has to say about our changing world and the changing worldview around us. It's just Rabbi Zacharias' book, Why Jesus. Just let me just show you. Has given me a lot of the ideas for the sermon. Please read this book. It takes a couple of readings to really get to grips with it, because it's deep language, but it's very important. Okay, he says, the likes of Michael Foucault, Jacques Derrida, and others framed the world of postmodernism and deconstruction. While these terms merit a rigorous philosophical analysis, the resulting authority was clearly the individual, and the reader claimed authority over the author. The tale would go something like this. In the beginning, God spoke, but that was a long time ago. We wanted certainty now. For this, only reason and rationalism would do, but that was not enough. We wanted to test, so we went into the senses and we found the empirical. But that's not what we meant by testing. We really meant feeling. So we went around, we found a way to generate feeling into a picture. Truth was framed into a scene, and the scene was left open to interpretation. Scenes are not absolute, so the story was told as an art form, but the reader still didn't like it because he was not the author. So he read the story while he sat in a reconstructed and deconstructed cubicle to make of the story whatever he wished. And what does one do with the long reach of the empirical? The best way to find a blend between the empirical and the satirical and end up with God again. The best way was, let's say. The only difference was that God could not be the storyteller. because they didn't want him to be. We still needed God, so we became God. This is a long way around to describe to you the new spirituality movement that is pervading our society today and is pushing itself on our culture. And if you're not aware of it, you're influenced by it. So you can't just be passive and receive whatever is out there coming at your way, because it will have an element of the new spirituality entwined in it if it's not biblical. So the purpose of my sermon is to highlight that for you, so that you are equipped to deal better with what you see out there. Okay, I'm just finding another little reference here. So this is in the words of Elizabeth Lesser, who's one of the gurus, let's say, of the new spirituality. She says, she's trying to define it. She says, in our times, it seems best described as the 21st century spirituality. It contains the nature-centered traditions of the original peoples of the Americas. It is part science, which has underscored for most of the 20th century our unspoken collective philosophy. I've experienced a lot of science, which is not at all science, but anyway, in their way of thinking. And it respects both a mistrust of heavy-handed authority and the willing surrender to a greater power. Sorry, it doesn't mistrust, it respects both a mistrust of heavy-handed authority and the willing surrender to a greater power. It draws from the religious teachings of the past and biblical traditions, the spiritual roots of Africa, the meditative schools of Asia, and other diverse mythic and religious worldviews. And it draws from our own times, from the wisdom of psychology, democracy, and feminism. Right, so we've covered all the bases, just to make sure nothing was left out, and science was also included in that. I find it quite comical, but anyway, let me just put my little marker here, because I don't want to lose another space. Right, and there's lots to be said, but I can't tell you all of it. Please read the book, but I just want to highlight what she says about authority. This is her definition of authority. In the old spirituality, authority is held by the church. In the new spirituality, the individual worshipper has authority to determine what is best for him or her. And what she says about truth, in the old spirituality, truth is knowable and constant, leading to the same answers at every stage of life. In the new spirituality, you never quite arrive at the truth, as it is constantly changing to accommodate your growth. Okay. I wonder how this definition of truth proposed by Elizabeth Lesser stands up to the laws of logic. And as Rabbi Zacharias says in his book, Jesus Amongst Other Gods, this is this quote here, truth is not only a matter of offense in that it makes certain assertions, it's also a matter of defense in that it must be able to make a cogent and sensible response to the counterpoints that are raised. My little budding mathematician, Brendan, would also question the ideas of logic that were presented earlier. Okay. If A equals B, but B does not equal C, then what's he covering up? Then A cannot also equal to C, can it? Yes. But the new spirituality philosophy would say, well, it can be just when it suits you, you know, or next year it might be the case. Okay? Or it might suit Don, but it won't suit me for today. Now, if we try to extrapolate that into the world that we live in, if we really, really took that seriously, that things change and truth changes as we want it to, then I would be rather scared to drive over the new Umgeni Bridge, because the physics that were used and the maths that was used to develop that bridge, which is about to be finished, hopefully, might not work next week. So because if A plus B equals C this week, it must still equal that next week for the bridge to still stay up. Okay? There's got to be some constancy in our world. And God has given us minds and brains to work out those laws of physics. And he hasn't told us to ignore them. He still overrides them. He can walk on water and he can do miracles, but it's not for us to override them. Okay, and then just say, well, it just suits us to one day believe this and not the next. So I was pondering on all these issues this week. Manus came home with a trail magazine after running a trail race on Wednesday. And I thought, oh, great, just some light reading. But of course, it brought me back to my sermon. And here I found lots of very good examples of the new spirituality that's pervading our world. So you can go on to the next one. Oh, sorry. That was just another quote. Yeah, we can come back to that another day. All right. Basically, that quote was about maths being a measure of our intellectual truthfulness. So we can't be, decide it's not. Okay, so I'm reading through the trail magazine, and I find this lady talking about how it was so wonderful to run with her daughter, who could salute the mountains at the top of the mountain when she was running her race, and how calming and centering it was for the central nervous system. I love the way they've thrown in some truth, so-called truth or scientific explanation there, and as a physiotherapist, and I have studied in depth into the orthopedic manipulative therapies, I don't see where the central nervous system is being relaxed at that point. I think her balance might be good, but I wouldn't do that with a patient anyway on top of a mountain. Okay, next one. Right, so this is called The Downward Dog. And this is an article written in a magazine that is meant for the consumption of the general public, and which is scary for me because I would then treat the general public who comes to my practice and asks me why their feet go into pins and needles and they can't feel them for 20 minutes after holding this pose for 5 minutes. And they're very disappointed with themselves that their physiology must be very wrong, that they get pins and needles in their feet for holding this position. Well, your neural system is on full stretch here, pretty much, except for if her neck was a bit more flexed, she would be in a fully flexed, full stretch nervous system stretch. Okay, your nervous system can stretch, actually, or be put under tension. But in the article describing it, she says, I get all worked up, you must just calm me down. The benefits of the downward dog. Okay. This is called the Adhomushka Svanasan, described by Iyengar, which is a famous yogi. And you hear people saying, but I do this type of yoga and I do that type, and this one's better than that type. They're all fighting each other as to which is right. And they actually come from a tradition of supposed to be peaceful, so I don't know why they're fighting. Anyway, Iyengar holds this downward-facing dog pose every single day for 25 minutes. Benefits of the downward-facing dog. It builds bone density. Downward-facing dog places weight on your arms and shoulders, which builds upper body strength and preserves bone density. Numerous studies have shown that bone density is improved with repetitive load, especially through the heel, walking at fast pace, lifting weights repetitively. So staying in one position for too long is not going to build bone density. Cells only respond to repeated impact. Okay, so we toss that one out, okay? And I'm not just getting excited on the physio side. I want to show you that these folk have a spiritual agenda, and they're pushing it, and they're trying to make it sound scientific, and therefore catch the public, but in the end, there's a whole spiritual stuff behind it, okay? It eliminates stiffness and back pain. Well, to start with, you'll get back pain if you try that and you're stiff to start with. So if you're stiff and you try that, you'll get back pain. So it makes no sense. There's no logic there. And it boosts circulation. Any pose where the heart is above the head is good for the circulatory system. So maybe it's good for your hands, but her feet are below her heart. So not very good for the circulation in her feet. And encourages blood flow through the body. An active circulatory system helps flush toxins from our body, keeps our immune system up tip-top shape, and helps regulate blood pressure. Probably we could improve our circulation doing it once off, but staying there for 25 minutes, you might have a headache and improved circulation in your head, but your feet will be running pins and needles. Okay, there's a few other things. They also say it decompresses your spine, tones and strengthens your arms, opens the arch of your feet and scalps and lengthens your thighs, and is an amazing shoulder opener. And I've treated patients who've dislocated their shoulder doing this. So you can open your shoulders, but you can dislocate them too. So this gets me very worked up, because I was a physio treating many people who were involved with yoga, and they used to be attracted to me for some reason. The one lady kept saying, "But you're so spiritual. I sent all my yoga friends to you." And I so wanted to say to them, "Well, I am, but you want to hear it? You want to just give me a chance to give me my whole, the whole way I think, not just, you know." Anyway, go there again. So, yoga is just an example of the introduction of the new spirituality into our culture. It's not the only one. Many of the other alternative practices are involved, and I probably will speak about that in the future. But I just wanted to use this as an example to show you how to assess things. So we can assess it both from a physical level or from a medical level. From my side, I can see a lot of issues with things being promoted that are not true. And yet, if a Christian was to promote something, they would get slammed down rather quickly, even if it was the truth from the Word. And then, secondly, for you to realize that there's not always hidden, but people may say there's no spiritual root behind it, but it's very, very definitely cannot be separated from the spiritual. The yoga instructors themselves will say that, maybe not virgin active, but So how was yoga popularized, and how did it come, well, how did, not just yoga, but how did the Eastern way of thinking come to our Western world as we know today? Comes back to in 1893, a chap called Vivekananda, one of the famous gurus from India, who was apparently quite a genius, he arrived at Parliament, at the Parliament of World Religions in Chicago. He was quite aggressive, and he was very clever. And at the time, there was a lot of upheaval in the world, a lot of war, and so he used it to his advantage. He says, "Brothers and sisters, we who come from the East have sat here on the platform day after day and have been told in a patronizing way that we ought to accept Christianity because Christian nations are the most prosperous. We look about us and we see England, the most prosperous Christian nation in the world, with her foot on the neck of 250 million Asiatics. We look back into history and see that the prosperity began with the invasion of Mexico. Christianity wins its prosperity by cutting the throats of its fellow men. At such a price, the Hindu will not have prosperity. I have sat here today and I have heard the height of intolerance. I have heard the creeds of the Muslim applauded when today the Muslim sword is carrying destruction to India. Blood and sword are not for the Hindu, whose religion is based on the laws of love." And he, obviously there was truth in that, but he used that platform he had to open the people's hearts to what was to come. And from there, even if you read in the yoga websites and their references, they see that as the entry point for when the East came to the West. Okay, from that day, and so people's hearts were opened to receive I'm not just saying from the East, because there's definitely Christians in the East, but from the Eastern philosophies. Okay. All right. Pop into one more. Okay. And this is where we see, this is what's happening in our world today. God gave them up in the lusts of their heart to impurity, to the dishonoring of their bodies among themselves, because they exchanged the truth about God for a lie, and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. And so we see that people were disillusioned with honoring with what Christianity had brought them, and they started to look for other gods, but in the end they've actually come back to looking at themselves and to promote themselves. And a lot of folk who are involved in Eastern religions or have a veneer of being very peace-loving and looking to love and help others and serve others, but many people I've met, most of them, I could say, are very self-centered. They're so busy trying to fix their problems with all these Eastern things they're doing, well, different things, spiritual stuff that they're doing, not just Eastern, that they're really sad. I've got examples of many patients who were just really in a terrible state. My one patient who's a yoga instructor who has severe lower neck osteoarthritis was quite depressed. And she, I could explain to her clearly that doing a headstand on your neck, they kind of put their head backwards and feet up in the air for 10 minutes a day is really not good for your neck. That is why you're losing sensation in your hands. But the so-called benefits spiritually for her of doing that movement were too important for her to give that up. It was like she was in bondage to having to do these things every day. Do you know what I mean? It's a headstand, shoulder stand. They've like this, the head is my hand and the feet are up in the air. And my heart really goes out to these folk. Most of them, you know, that I have reference for, my patients. They're really lovely people. The same lady, one day when I was treating her neck, admitted to me that she's not sure about all of this that she believes. She's still searching for truth. She says she does think there's a God out there. She's just not quite sure she's found what she's looking for. So in a vulnerable place, these folk often will admit that they're not really there, that they're really struggling. Another chap I treated who was very involved in Tai Chi, he taught it and he was a major proponent of Feng Shui and all of this stuff. And when I assessed him, he sort of quietly leaned towards me and he said, "But you know, it hasn't worked for me. All these years I've taught it." He's an old man. He says, "It hasn't really worked for me, but I still teach it, you know, because I've got to teach something, you know." And it's just so sad to me. And I Manus would have me stand up and and give them a sermon there and then give them the gospel. We often used to have discussions about, can I charge them for the physio session if I've just, I can't just preach to them. Right. And even in my own heart, I must say, because of my exposure to lots of other alternative practices, I've had to really guard my heart and just determine, is this something I can be involved in, or is it something that I must be cautious of? I went to a course in England on the shoulder, and it was a myofascial release course. I thought it was to do with stretching fascia and whatever, and it seemed to start off all right. And then the chap said, "We must please go stand about a meter away from the wall and start to feel the energy bouncing off the wall. So put your hands like this and feel the energy bouncing off the wall. Can you feel it? Can you feel it?" And everyone's going, "Yeah, yeah, we can feel it." And I was just like, "No, this is silly." So I fold my arms. And he says, are you not participating?" I said, "No." He says, I'm sorry, sir. I'm not. This is a physiotherapy course, and I'm not participating." And I walked out, and I walked around the building praying in tongues for a while and left home, and I didn't go back the next day. And this was in a very expensive physiotherapy training course in England, and they were throwing that in. But it can be much more subtle than that. It can just be the way people are portraying choices that you've made or choices that others have made. And I even heard my mom the other day saying, "Well, you've got to give everybody their say," you know, which is true. They can say what they want, but the truth remains the same. That we can't just change the truth according to what everybody says. Okay. Let's go to something a little more lighthearted. This is a joke, okay. There was a doctor in a psychiatric ward talking his patient out of believing that he was Moses. But the patient was convinced that he was Moses. So the doctor asked him frustratedly, "Who told you you're Moses?" And the patient replies, "God did." And from next door came an indignant voice, "I did not." So we have an issue with reality, a problem with reality there. But it's not so obvious, but in many people's hearts there's a subtle Yeah, that thing of who is actually God? Is it in me? Can I find him in me? Okay, come on to the next one. Right. When I was a university lecturer of physio students, I taught clinical reasoning. So that's the way you reason through a diagnosis or treatment and see if it's going to work, assess the person as a whole. And students would sometimes make these great grand claims. This patient has acute back pain, so he must wear a brace, or he must be booked off work for 3 days. And my reply to them was usually, who said it? Who says so? And why did he say so? And when did he say so? And, you know, which author was that? And so too, when Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life, we can ask who says so. And we need to ask these questions. Who says so? So Jesus has been spoken about by 40 different authors who either lived with him or were exposed to his disciples. And they claimed that he was the only one in charge. And his motivation, what would his motivation have been if he wasn't the Son of God? Why would he have put his life on the line? Why would he have gone all the way to the cross if he wasn't the Son of God? He says, I am the true vine, and my Father is the vine dresser. Every branch in me that does not bear fruit, he takes away. And every branch that does bear fruit, he prunes that it may bear more fruit. So if he's been working in you and his fruit is evident in your life, then you know you're with him, you've been with him. But if the fruit isn't there, like in my patients, that sadness, that desperate searching, I can't say they found God. Have they found God in themselves? They haven't looked to Jesus, the source of that. Go on, one more for me. I think I've missed something here. Yeah, Jesus says, yeah, oh, come to the one with the, that one. So Jesus is the light. He says, I am the true light, which gives light to everyone. Oh, sorry, this is John 1, verse 9. It's not him speaking, but it says, the true light, Jesus was the true light, which gives light to everyone. And he was coming into the world. So we come back to that description of light coming into our eyes. Oh dear, in my notes. that the eye is really just is a collection of specialized cells. And in simple terms, it's a retina, a cornea, and a lens, and a retina, and water. And with the brain, it becomes a powerful interface. Jesus needs to shed his light onto our eyes so that we can see through his eyes. So if we can allow his light to shine on the world and that shine on us, how much more will we see? Will we see these things that are in the world out there that are trying to pervade our culture, that are trying to influence us, confuse us? We'll be able to stand up for those who are innocent consumers, like many of my patients, who would read things and just do them because so it says it's scientific. We need to be more discerning than that. Okay, because behind the scenes of the new spirituality, there really is a deep hunger for truth. And I love people who are involved in this. I find it hard to work with them, but I love these people. They really are desperately searching, but we cannot allow them to influence us, okay? And we cannot continue to think that we can look inside of us for truth. We need to look outward. Okay. Look at this exchange that Jesus had with this woman. This is just such a beautiful, beautiful picture. Won't read it all, but it shall start here. But the hour is coming and is here now when the true worshippers will worship the Father in spirit and truth. For the Father is seeking such people to worship him. God is spirit, and those who worship must worship in spirit and truth. The woman said to him, I know that Messiah is coming, he who is called Christ. When he comes, he will tell us all things. Jesus said to her, I who speak to you am he. So that hunger that's burning inside of many people, that's the solution. Jesus is that bread and that water. Please take it to them. And don't let them tell you that you're just one of them and one of the many things that you can believe.